What if I told you that a single species of fish rewired global politics, funded revolutions, and ultimately taught us the limits of human ambition? The Atlantic cod, an unremarkable-looking creature with a protruding jaw and insatiable appetite, has shaped more of human history than most world leaders. For nearly five centuries, this fish powered empires, sparked wars, and fed millions. Then, in a single generation, we wiped it out. This isn't just an environmental cautionary tale. It's the story of how a humble fish became the thread connecting medieval exploration, American independence, and our modern reckoning with nature's limits. Picture a fish so easy to catch that medieval sailors claimed you could lower a basket into the water and pull up dinner. The Atlantic cod evolved into nature's vacuum cleaner, a wide-mouthed predator that devours anything fitting through its gullet. Unlike muscular fish that fight when hooked, cod simply rise to the surface like waterlogged pillows, their swim bladders distended from pressure changes. This passivity made them tragically vulnerable to exploitation. What made cod revolutionary was its flesh, the whitest of all fish, containing virtually no fat and over 18% protein. Cod could be dried to create a product that was 80% pure protein, one of the most nutrient-dense foods ever discovered. Before refrigeration, this made cod nature's protein bar, perfect for long voyages and food-scarce regions. Every part was usable: head, liver, roe, even bones. The vitamin-packed liver became cod liver oil, a supplement generations of children learned to dread. Long before Columbus, Basque fishermen were quietly harvesting North American waters. These mysterious Pyrenees people, whose language connects to no other on Earth, discovered Newfoundland's rich fishing grounds by the 1400s, but kept their gold mine secret. When John Cabot discovered Newfoundland in 1497, he reported seas so thick with cod that sailors could catch them with weighted baskets. 37 years later, Jacques Cartier arrived to find 1,000 Basque vessels already operating there. The impact was seismic. By mid-century, cod constituted 60% of all fish eaten in Europe, a percentage that held for two centuries. Sleepy coastal villages became bustling commercial centers overnight. La Rochelle became Europe's premier fishing port, despite lacking river access. The French salt tax fueled revolution. The British forged strategic alliances with Portugal for superior salt. By the late 1500s, Sir Walter Raleigh declared that losing the Newfoundland fleet would be the greatest blow ever given to England. A fish had become national security. The Pilgrims didn't land at Plymouth Rock by accident. They were following the cod. Captain John Smith had charted New England's coast in 1614, and his reports of abundant fish directly influenced where the Pilgrims settled. As Governor William Bradford admitted, they picked Plymouth chiefly for the hope of present profit to be made by the fish. Despite settling atop Earth's richest fishing grounds, the Pilgrims proved spectacularly inept fishermen. Native Americans mockingly nicknamed them Kinchon, fish. Colonists viewed lobsters, which literally piled up on beaches, with revulsion, eating them only during the desperate winter of 1621-22. This fishing incompetence gave way to commercial genius. Unlike Newfoundland's seasonal stations, New England offered ice-free harbors, fertile soil, and year-round cod spawning. Colonists created an ingenious trade triangle: dried cod to Europe and the Caribbean, molasses and sugar back to New England, rum and manufactured goods to Europe. Adam Smith praised New England's fishery in The Wealth of Nations as a model of free market capitalism. This economic independence proved crucial. You can't easily control people who don't need you. By the 18th century, Massachusetts had transformed cod into a symbol of power. The codfish aristocracy carved wooden cod for official buildings and stamped fish on coins. This prosperity concealed a brutal foundation. Caribbean sugar plantations required cheap protein for enslaved workers, enduring 16-hour days. New England merchants supplied the market with lowest quality cod, West India cure. By 1645, they operated triangulated trade, premium fish to Spain, inferior cod to Caribbean plantations for sugar and molasses, and direct participation in the slave trade. Salt cod stretched with rice became fuel for plantation slavery. This embodied Alexis de Tocqueville's great social enigma, freedom-loving New Englanders profiting from the system they opposed. When revolution erupted, it centered on trade freedom. Britain's Molasses Act and Sugar Act drove merchants toward rebellion. During Paris peace negotiations, John Adams fought as fiercely for Grand Banks' fishing rights as for independence itself, arguing cod fishermen were indispensably necessary to American independence, a nursery of seamen and a source of naval power. Fishing the North Atlantic meant confronting death daily. Temperatures plunged below minus 30 F, massive icebergs lurked in fog, and fishermen wore thin rubber nippers, losing fingers to frostbite. From the 17th century until the 1930s, vessels deployed dozens of dories, 20-foot wooden skiffs with two-man crews. Men became lost in fog banks lasting days, unable to locate motherships. Many drowned when waves swamped their craft. Others died from exposure or starvation. Between 1830 and 1900, Gloucester, Massachusetts alone lost 3,800 fishermen, 70% more than all American casualties in the War of 1812. A single night in 1862 claimed 120 fishermen when a gale swept George's Bank. Even today, fishing remains the deadliest occupation in North Atlantic countries, with mortality rates 20 times higher than manufacturing. Yet overfishing concerns were dismissed as hysteria. Thomas Henry Huxley declared such fears unscientific in 1883, arguing declining catches would naturally correct themselves. This dangerous optimism became entrenched policy. Meanwhile, technology advanced relentlessly. Mechanized trawlers, five-mile gill nets, bottom draggers, accelerating toward inevitable collapse. In July 1992, Canada's fisheries minister announced a moratorium on fishing northern cod, putting 30,000 fishermen out of work. 3 years shy of the 500-year anniversary of Cabot's reports of inexhaustible abundance, the fishery was over. The cod hadn't gone biologically extinct, they'd become commercially extinct, too rare to be worth catching. The contrast between Iceland and Newfoundland tells the whole story. Iceland gained independence, carefully managed its fisheries, and fought three cod wars to protect its waters. Newfoundland became a Canadian province and watched as government-backed conglomerates invested heavily in offshore draggers that intercepted spawning cod before they could reach inshore waters. When inshore fishermen complained their catches were vanishing, authorities ignored them. The government had invested in offshore fishing and needed that investment to succeed. Similar scenes played out across the North Atlantic. In Cornwall's Newlyn, fishing vessels were decommissioned, cut up for scrap as governments paid fishermen to reduce fleet sizes. In Gloucester, multi-generational fishing families sold out, erasing centuries of specialized knowledge about reading weather, finding fish, and respecting the sea's rhythms. The thousand-year tradition of hunting Atlantic cod has ended, not with triumph, but with silence. We mastered the technology to catch every fish, but never learned when to stop. The cod story isn't just about one species. It's about every time we mistake abundance for infinity, efficiency for wisdom.